My name is Dick Gilden. The title of this session is Nicaragua, a Case Study of Oppression. Just a bit of background about myself. I am by profession an electrical engineer. I have an engineering firm in Minneapolis. I also am advocating serving as the chairperson of the Center for Global Service and Education in Minneapolis, which is affiliated with Augsburg College. Its role is to, among other things, sponsor seminar study trips to Central America for the purpose of studying justice issues in that place. The center also conducts other types of seminars and sponsors conferences and that sort of thing, all directed toward raising awareness in third world countries, and more specifically in Latin America, and even more specifically in Central America. I have some newsletters here from the center. If you're interested in seeing one of those and taking one of those, you're welcome to do so. And if you wish to get on the mailing list for that, you could simply put your name on this list. The reason I mention that is that the center represents one of many sources of information on what is happening in Central America. There are a number of places where we can get a perspective that is perhaps somewhat different than we see in the mass media. I don't know if it's been your experience, but certainly it's been mine, and that is that there is a considerable amount of conflicting information coming to us on the issues in Central America. And I find myself thinking, what are we to believe on these issues? And I hear more and more people say that to me as I've been involved in speaking on it. And so I would simply offer that I think there is a lot of information, a lot of sources that are available for us to get information. And I think it's important that we do ask questions about it, that we do critically analyze the information we get, in that it is clear we're getting quite a bit of conflicting information. In this session, I'd like to talk for a while about the U.S. involvement in Nicaragua. And that has primarily been since the turn of the century, and can generally, and by almost any standards, be generally categorized as being oppressive to that country. Then, on the other hand, I want to say that in my visit to Nicaragua, that was, and I should say a word about that, about a year ago, I went on one of the study seminars sponsored by the Center for Global Service and Education. And that involved a rather intense 2 weeks of interviewing people, talking to people, a week in Cuernavaca, Mexico, and a week in Nicaragua, morning, noon, and night, talking to people in that place, such people as people in the street, people in organizations, farm organizations, the UN Embassy, we talked to the United States Ambassador to Nicaragua, we talked to persons in the government of Nicaragua, in the private sector, we talked to people on the State Farm, the head of the penal system, just as some examples of people we talked to in the study trip. But getting back to the point I wanted to make, and that is that while generally it can be said that U.S. involvement there has resulted in oppressive conditions for people, we can also say that there are Americans there that are doing marvelous things in terms of serving people there, and it's heartwarming to see them. And to a great extent, the warmness of the Nicaraguan people to us as North Americans there, I think reflects to a considerable extent some of the marvelous things that some other Americans here are doing now. On the other hand, I also have to say that there is some resentment and bitterness on the part of the Nicaraguan people with regard to the United States foreign policy, with regard to that country. What I'd like to do is go back in history and give you some historical background. I'm not going to go all the way back to the beginning. I'll just say a word or two about that. And that is that, as you probably recall, the Central America was conquered by the Spanish in about 1520. And for the next 300 years, lived essentially as a Spanish colony. American interest, that is, interest of the United States, started principally around the turn of the century, although certainly we were interactive with Central America during the 19th century. But about the turn of this century is when we became somewhat, not intensively, but increasingly interested in that place. At the turn of the century, Nicaragua was considered to be a strong candidate for the canal. That is, the canal from the Atlantic to the Pacific. And as such, we were quite interested in it. Teddy Roosevelt bragged that as president, he took the isthmus for the Panama Canal. He took the isthmus for the Panama Canal as if it were a pawn on a chessboard. And to a considerable extent, our perspective, or at least the history of U.S. intervention in Central America, has continued to be of that nature. We've identified it that way, a pawn on a chessboard. In 1911, U.S. banks started to lend money in Nicaragua, and as a condition of some of those loans, some of the conditions were that the United States would protect some of the interests of... No, I shouldn't say that. Let me take that back. The loans were made to Nicaragua under agreements that gave the bank control over its finances until those debts were paid in something like the mid-20s. In 1912, at the request of the Nicaraguan government, or president, I should say, Diaz, U.S. Marines landed in Nicaragua to put down forces that opposed American control of those investments. From 1912 to 1933, United States Marines remained almost continuously to protect U.S. interests there. The U.S. occupation was bitterly resented by many of the Nicaraguans, and rebels led by a man by the name of Augusto Cesar Sandino made raids from the mountains on the Marines and ultimately was instrumental in the Marines leaving that place. During its occupation, particularly in the last few years of its occupation by the United States Marines, we trained a very powerful National Guard and placed at its head Anastasio Somoza. This was about in 1934. Sandino at that time was somewhat of a national hero. However, in 1934, after the Marines had left, Somoza invited Sandino to a celebration or a peace celebration dinner, at which time he had Sandino executed. That started then a period from 1934, and it lasted until 1979, during which the Nicaraguan country was ruled by Somoza. I'm going to recommend a book to you. It's Cry of the People by Penny Lernell. I'm going to read a couple of excerpts from it because I think it will give you a sort of a very quick view of the nature of the Somozan rule, that is, from 1934 to 1979. I'm going to read a little excerpt that speaks in terms of today, but makes a reference to Somoza at the time of the first part of the dynasty, that is, in the late 30s. This is a quote from a rural teacher, a current rural teacher. "Teaching people to think is the worst crime you can commit under the Somoza government," said a rural teacher whose school had been closed by the National Guard. Ex-President Somoza's father, Anastasio Sr., who founded the family dynasty in 1936, would surely have agreed. While on an official visit to Costa Rica, he listened while his colleague there boasted of the schools the government was building. Finally, Somoza could stand it no longer. "I don't want educated people," he snorted. "I want action." In 1979, at the time of the successful overthrow of the Somozan government, illiteracy in Nicaragua was somewhat in excess of 50%. Very high. Well, another story, another account. This is well known. In fact, most of the things I'm saying tonight are quite publicly known and almost not legendary, but they're almost that way. FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, was told by one of his advisors during much of the oppressive time of the early Somoza, he said, one of his advisors told him, Somoza is an SOB. He's doing a lot of things down there that are pretty drastic. Roosevelt's response was, yes, but he is our SOB. And I think that kind of describes the position that we have taken sometimes under the surface. That is, we are happy to have the stability, or have been happy to have the stability in Central America, even though we know that some of the things that are taking place there are pretty drastic. We have valued that stability very highly. During the Somozan rule, the Somoza family dominated the country until Anastasio Somoza's son was overthrown in the revolution in 1979. During this 45-year period, the Somoza family either ruled as president of that country or as the real power behind the presidency. It is a story of terror, torture, hunger, and economic injustice. The terror became particularly bad in the 70s under Anastasio II. I'd like to read another excerpt or two from Penny Lernau's book to give you some sort of feel for the type of things that were taking place under the rule of the National Guard during the Somoza regime. And there's a couple of paragraphs. And I'm quoting, caught between National Guard and guerrillas, Sofana's 50 families met in the district rustic chapel to decide whether to move to Siana, a town to the north, or come together in a small village for mutual protection. They never did decide because in February 1976, five National Guard patrols stormed the district. They had a list of names, said an eyewitness, and they moved from one isolated hut to the next, taking the men out, beating and torturing them in front of their families, demanding that they divulge the name of guerrilla collaborators in the area. These men were then marched out into the fields and shot. Women and children were also murdered, among them an 8-year-old boy who was hanged and then decapitated. Among the peasants killed were Fernando Garcia and his family, who had formed the backbone of the community and owned some 1,200 acres along the Yaos River. The land thereupon became the property of Commander Gonzalo Everett, National Guard chief of Zalela, until his promotion in 1976 to head the Managua Traffic Department. Everett was remembered in the region not only for his ferocity, but also for his unusual suspenders, which were covered with U.S. insignia, souvenirs no doubt from one of the 9 courses he had taken in counterinsurgency and police training in the Panama Canal Zone and the United States. We trained and armed the Somoza National Guard during that period. And another one. In another incident in Matagalpa, attested to by Amnesty International, the entire family of the owner of the Hotel Souza was machine-gunned by the National Guard, the owner being castrated before he was killed. In their concern for the young, Amnesty International reports coincided with those of the OAS Commission. In some areas, Amnesty International stated, all males over 14 years old were reportedly shot dead. In Leon, eyewitnesses told of the execution on September 15th of 22 young men. They made the persons kneel in two lines. It seemed like thousands of shots. We could see a guard shooting his submachine gun at the people riding on the ground. They then drove a tractor over the body. On September 8th, most of the young men of the town of Catarina were detained. 7 were later found dead on the outskirts of town. And on and on. We hear the story so often. Do you remember this television coverage of Bill Spear being shot? That was, let's see, it must have been in about 1978. Bill Stewart, who was a reporter in Minneapolis at one of the television stations, was covering something in Nicaragua at the time, and this was on all major television networks here. He was made to lay down and shot in the head, and we saw it on national television. That particular incident aroused the ire of the American people and our government, and we then withdrew support of the Somozan regime under Jimmy Carter, the president at the time. But it's that kind of thing that was rampant during the Somocean period. It's estimated that some 30,000 people died in Nicaragua during the Somocean years under that kind of tyranny. During our visit, we talked to Mary Hartman, who is now the head of the Human Rights Commission in Nicaragua. She's a Mary Mole nun. I can't remember where she's from in the United States, but she's a delightful person, just a marvelous person. And she said that 10 years ago, she had a youth group that was made up of 90 young people in Managua, and today only 50% of them are still living, due to either the National Guard killing prior to the revolution and also the fighting during the revolution. We were told several times while we were there, it was almost against the law to be young during that revolutionary period, because a lot of the revolution was being fought out by young people in that country. During this period, that is the period of the Somocean rule, the Somoza family amassed great wealth, including 30% of the arable land of that country. That family essentially had almost no money at the time he took over as head of the National Guard. During this period, they acquired 40% of Nicaragua's industry, and the 26 largest companies in that country were owned by Somoza. The family amassed hundreds of millions of dollars in cash. Just a few side comments here. Anastasio II was educated at West Point in the United States and had several friends in the United States Congress. As a result of the Nicaraguan lobby, there was a very strong one in Washington. With many friends in Congress, Nicaragua's lobby was very powerful and was able to implement things within our congressional process. Let me read you another quick excerpt. This type of thing is so well documented, and it's frightening to hear this sort of thing. In May 1978, the Nicaraguan lobby again used its leverage to unfreeze $12.5 million in U.S. loans for non-military programs and a $32 million soft loan from the Inter-American Development Bank to construct a road between two military garrisons in the northern department of Zuluhela. It was in the same area that some 600 peasants were killed by the National Guard, according to missionaries. In further support of Somoza, President Carter sent him a letter of congratulations for the improvement in human rights, apparently on the advice of the faction in the State Department that believed the only alternative to Somoza was communism, the very argument of the Nicaraguan dictator. The observation of Nicaragua's former ambassador to the United Nations, Enrique Paguaga Fernandez, said that Somoza claims he has more friends in Congress than Carter does, may also have prompted the incredible letter. As if to prove Somoza's claim, 78 members of Congress sent Carter a letter supporting the Somoza regime at the height of the September 1978 slaughter, initiated by Somoza's good friend Congressman Murphy and by Representative Larry McDonald. The letter was intended, said McDonald's administrative assistant Fred Smith, to let the Nicaraguan government know that not everyone in the United States is against it. This is at the height of the massacres that were taking place. In 1979, the Sandinista Liberation Front, which was formed and named after Augusto Sandino, the national hero, led the revolution after a long and very bitter battle and finally overthrew the Somoza government. That happened on July 19th, 1979. At least that's the time they celebrate the overthrow of the Somoza regime. 50,000 people died in the revolution. That's out of a population of 2.5 million. There were very, very heavy losses. At the time of this triumphant revolution, it was a country devastated by war, number one. It was just devastated. In the last months of the revolution, Somoza had his own city bombed. He was bombing Managua during that period. It was a country impoverished after years of exploitation and injustice. And I think it needs to be said, at the time of the revolution, almost every faction within that country was for the revolution. Everyone, with just a few exceptions, that is, a few people close to Somoza, were back the revolution. It was a very popularly backed revolution. And at the time of the triumphant revolution, it was a country with $1.6 billion in foreign debt, which was left over from the Somozan regime. Somoza had left for Miami, Florida, and lived there for a while. Much of the money that he had accumulated, in fact, all of it, had left the country and was either in the United States Bank or, I presume, some Swiss bank. There was only about $3 million left in the treasury, which was barely sufficient for one day reserve for that country to operate. And just a few words about Nicaragua today. There is free health care available to most Nicaraguans today. Before the revolution, there wasn't. At the time of the revolution, the government instigated a national literacy campaign and reduced the literacy from the 50% figure I mentioned to 12%. There was very merciful treatment by the government of the former Somoza National Guardsmen, the ones we read about in the cry of people that were carrying out these massacres were captured, of course. There were 8,000 of them. Immediately upon the success of the revolution, capital punishment was banned, period. No one was killed at the time of that successful revolution. Even the National Guard persons who were operated in such a brutal way. And many of the people in Nicaragua resented that. They wanted the government to implement much, much harsher treatment of the National Guardsmen. Many grassroots organizations are being formed, including labor unions, farm workers associations, and women's groups. Nicaragua is one country now in Latin America that does pay high value or place high value on the rights of all of its persons, irregardless of race, or irregardless of sex, for example, which has typically in Latin America been a cause for some inequality. Land reclamation is taking place. It's been relatively easy in that country to do that, though, because all of the land that Somoza owned immediately became available for redistribution to many of the landless peasants in that country. So land reclamation has been relatively easy for them to handle. There are some negative things that are happening there. There has been censorship of the press since the declaration in 1982 that the country is on a war footing. There is some resistance today by certain sectors within Nicaragua. The private sector isn't as happy as it might be with the government in Nicaragua now, because generally speaking, it is implementing a socialist type of government where there is distribution of the wealth to poorer people in the country. It's sort of a combination of socialism together. I guess I should say they're looking for a mixed economy, one which is to a great extent public and to a great extent private. So they're looking for sort of a mix of economic structures there. Let's see. Let me go on. I want to talk just for a little bit about the foreign policy of the United States today there, because I think it's important for us to know it. And I've asked the question, what is the U.S. foreign policy in Central America? Incidentally, if you have any questions, please ask them as we're going along here, and then I hope we'll have some time for discussion. What is U.S. foreign policy in Central America? I guess it can be stated, this is the way I would state it at least, as I see it. It is to develop stability in Central America consistent with the interests of the United States. And President Reagan, in his April 27th speech, said the following: "The national security of all the Americas is at stake in Central America. If we cannot defend ourselves there, we cannot expect to prevail elsewhere. Our credibility would collapse, our alliances would crumble, and the safety of our homeland would be put in jeopardy. That's a strong position statement he made. He went on to say, 2/3 of all of our foreign trade and petroleum passed through the Panama Canal and the Caribbean. In a European crisis, at least half of our supplies for NATO would go through there, those areas by sea. Because of its importance, the Caribbean Basin is a magnet for adventurism. So we see here the statement by our president that in fact it is a very important area for us, and I don't downplay that at all. I think the statements he's making here are consistent with what our posture has been for a long time. Henry Kissinger said, it's time we stopped arguing only about how much democracy there is in El Salvador and begin to understand America's strategic interests are at stake. So he speaks to the Central American issue too, and the fact that America's strategic interests are at stake in that place. The next question I would ask is, why is our foreign policy what it is? And I'd like to talk just a minute about two perceptions I think that exist about Central America. Can you flip that projector on? This is going to be a unique thing, I think, for me anyway. It's going to be a one-slide show. And mainly because I wanted to get that for you, and all I had it on was a slide. So this is a one-slide show. These two statements, I think, set the two perspectives that we see with regard to Central America. The one statement is a statement by Jean Kirkpatrick, who is the United States Ambassador to the United Nations. And she says, there is a plan to create a communist Central America, which if successful will have momentous consequences for our security and that of our European allies and for the unfortunate people of Central America. The other statement is by Aldo Diaz, the Nicaraguan Foreign Ministry, and it says, the problems in Latin America are not due to the East-West struggle, but to archaic structures that make effective social justice impossible. I think that these two statements encapsulate the perspective that exists relative to that place. That is, two perspectives that stand in some juxtaposition with each other. The one on one hand sees what is taking place in Central America as one of communist intervention and a move of the Eastern Bloc particularly to move into that place. And a good deal of our foreign policy, I think, is structured around that particular perspective. The other one is a perspective that one hears more in Central America itself. Clearly, Aldo Diaz is in that place in Nicaragua. His statement is that those struggles are not so much involved in the East-West struggle as they are a struggle for people who want some dignity, who want to eat, who want to have health care, and that sort of thing. And that's the type of perspective that you get when you talk to people in that place. So we have those two perspectives that seem to be standing one against the other, not necessarily that they need to, but it seems that they do now find themselves in some tension. The East-West perception, typified by the left statement there, leads to assumptions relative to what is taking place in Central America, the revolution thing. Yeah, that's good to have it off. First of all, it leads to an assumption that they are Marxist. It leads to an assumption that the government, if they are successful, will immediately align with the Soviet Union. Third, it leads to the assumption that U.S. economic interests would suffer. And fourth, that U.S. security would be endangered. Many in our country, and I think our foreign policy with regard to Central America, does see the causes of the revolutions that are taking place in that place as communist intervention. And I think this has provided the basis of our foreign policy. I'll move quickly through these so we can have some time to talk.
That's an unusual thing to think so after Cuba, where that's exactly all the things you mentioned have.
Yes, I think it is not unusual for us to think that. And what I would offer at this point is that I believe that Nicaragua is offering a third alternative to either the Somoza type of military dictatorship, which we have supported so strongly in Central, not only in Nicaragua, but in Central America
in general, over and against an Eastern Bloc situation such as that in Cuba. I think Nicaragua offers an alternative to that, and so I want to develop a little bit of that. And I think your point is a good one. We see what happened in Cuba, and I think it supports the basis of the East-West struggle perception. I want to talk just for a minute about the strategy behind our intervention now in that place. First of all, we are supporting internal subversion. As you know, as became public last March, I think it was, but was known much earlier, the United States has supported covertly, that is, under the surface, the training and arming of contra-revolutionaries, primarily former Somoza National Guardsmen. We have fed, armed, trained, and supplied this group. They're called Somocistas. They are operating along the Honduran border and are making raids now into Nicaragua from the north. They are to a great extent, been trained on U.S. soil, which I might say violates United States law that says we will not train anyone who has the intent of overthrowing a government with which we have diplomatic relations. They are former Somoza National Guardsmen, for the most part, although it is reported that the CIA has sifted out of that group the most brutal of the National Guards persons prior to the revolution. President Reagan identified these, and I take exception with this, these people as freedom fighters. They're using tactics which are similar to their former tactics, and I am not, as you're starting to get a sense of where I'm at with regard to where I think our foreign policy should be. We have invested or spent $19 million for this covert action in that place. We have mobilized the military of other countries. The U.S. has essentially armed Honduras, which is just to the north of Nicaragua. We have, in 1982, we provided $17.5 million for military assistance to Honduras. We supplied 20 helicopters and six A-37 jet fighters to that place, to Honduras. In 1983, there's a request now for $21 million for airbase buildup in Honduras and $15 million for weapons and training for Honduras. Again, they are just on the northern border of Nicaragua. We have also offered a direct threat of military intervention, or I might say military intimidation. We have parked aircraft carriers and the task groups that go with them on the two shores of Nicaragua, although I don't know right now what is there, and then I haven't read the reports for 3 weeks. We also, I think, had the New Jersey there, the battleship New Jersey, with its support groups in place of one of the aircraft carriers. I don't know what is there now in terms of military, naval power of the American armed forces, but I know it's significant. We also are conducting army maneuvers, Big Pine 2. 4,000 to 5,000 U.S. troops are just within a few miles of the Nicaraguan border in Honduras, carrying out military exercises. John, I'm going to skip a few things here so we can talk. The U.S. has economically intervened. We have blocked loans. We have blocked food aid and economic aid. The Carter administration had provided $75 million in an aid package that was approved by Congress. And the intent of that aid was to prevent some of the radicalization of that country, that is, the move toward what happened in Cuba. At the time of the Reagan administration's start, they stopped $15 million of that remaining. And our administration now has canceled aid assistance to Nicaragua for the purchase of wheat and cooking oil. The U.S. has used its influence to block a World Bank loan to Nicaragua. We have cut the sugar quota, you may recall, not too long ago. We also we are boycotting that country with regard to spare parts. Now, just a moment or a word or two about why I think our foreign policy is going to be ineffective. A couple of things that I think our foreign policy fails to recognize is that there is a strong Christian makeup of the revolutionary people in Nicaragua. Nicaragua is very strongly Christian. The vast majority of the people there are Christian. One of the Protestant ministers that we visited with there, Jose Miguel Torres, said, "I believe that there's a higher percentage of Nicaraguan people now studying theology than any country in the entire world." There are base Christian communities that have provided a strong base of support for the revolutionary process. They see their revolution, incidentally, going on. They see the buildup of their society almost from the ground up as part of the revolutionary process. And a very substantial part of that is the base Christian communities that exist there. Four key positions in the Nicaraguan government today are held by Catholic priests. One of them, Miguel Descoto, quoted in a recent publication, "Fidelity to Christ means fidelity to people, to the poor, the ones who hunger and thirst for justice." My impression of those, it happens to be men, in that government is that their Christian orientation is very solid. There is a strong, another thing that I think our foreign policy fails to see, recognize, is that there's a strong base of people behind the revolution, that the causes of the revolutions in Central America are highly likely due more to internal conditions as opposed to communist intervention. And we see that in Nicaragua. We are being very unsuccessful with regard to the counter-revolutionaries. They just are receiving no popular support in Nicaragua. Our president Reagan said on his April 27 speech that there are people within Nicaragua that aren't supportive of it, and certainly there are, as I mentioned before, some of the private sector are speaking against it. But I think it's difficult, probably, to find many people in Nicaragua that want to overthrow their government. They want things changed, just as we want things changed. I mean, here I'm speaking about how I wish we had a change in our foreign policy. It's that kind of thing that's taking place. And so we aren't able to arouse people to be counter-revolutionaries there. We're not able to do that. The day after President Reagan's speech, some 50 to 100,000 people in Nicaragua gathered in the main square, many of them carrying their weapons. They're militia people, typically, and there were some 10 to 15,000 that had their weekend weapons with them. And in the midst of that, the almost the entire government of government leadership in Managua were there mingling among the crowd. And I would hasten to say that in a situation where there isn't very heavy popular support for a government, that kind of situation wouldn't take place, low security. Situation. I'm going to stop at this point. I have some other things I can go on with, but I'd like to maybe open it for questions and maybe get some discussions from you, from the group, rather. Are there questions relative to what I've been speaking about?
How do you feel about the group? Is it called Contador?
The Contador group, yes.
Yes.
The Contador group, which is made up of Mexico, you know them all, Panama, Venezuela.
Is it Colombia?
And Colombia, yes. They have suggested means by which the turmoil in Central America can be resolved by a negotiated settlement. I am very much in favor of that. I'm very much.
Sort of a grassroots type thing to me.
Yes. Yeah. Mexico has taken a very, very positive stand, I think, very positive posture on the side of a negotiated settlement there, whereby all foreign interests would leave, including the United States and the Soviet Union, where they are involved. And I think some of the proposals, in fact, most of the proposals of the Contador group, I think, are very sound ones. Many of our West European allies don't look very favorably at our foreign policy there. I think we do not have strong worldwide support in the policy that we're presently operating under in that place. Yes?
Do you think that our foreign policy is pretty much dictated by the U.S. multinational corporations that exist down in that area?
I think that, I don't know the answer to that problem. That it gets rather complex in the sense that there aren't many economic interests in, for example, Nicaragua that would change no matter what our position is. The ambassador told us, incidentally, that prior to the revolution and after the revolution, even now, the amount of foreign trade between us, our countries, is about the same, with the exception of now the sugar quota cut. So what I wanted to say was that the extent to which economic or business interests might be influencing our foreign policy, that would be a very complex sort of phenomenon that's taking place, and I don't know the answer to that. I would say that one would ask the question, why don't we support the Nicaraguan government? They have asked us to do so. They have said very, very clearly that they do not want to be aligned with the Soviet Union. They also don't want to be under the control of the United States, however, but they don't want to be aligned. So one would ask, why don't we support them? And my response to that would be that I think some of the economic interests that come to play in some of the other Central American countries would be at stake. If we were to support a revolutionary government in Nicaragua, then we in effect are supporting, at least implying support for revolutionary movements in El Salvador and Guatemala, where we do have economic interests. In Guatemala, there are American multinationals operating there, and that would be a consideration at that point.
Did your study group go out with any sanction from the State Department? Did you have any access to bringing any kind of a report back to the State Department?
No, we did not. We did not go with any sort of connections to our State Department under which we would report back to them. We had good conversation with the United States Ambassador in Managua, however.
Would there be any way you could make yourself available to any advisory group in
the State Department?
Yeah.
Well, we certainly could do that. I would say that there are a lot of Americans going to Nicaragua now, and I think that the State Department has fairly good access to peoples that have been there.
They maybe need to hear from a greater number of people.
They perhaps do, and that's why I have been speaking. And I would, my suggestion and the thing that I am doing is, to the best of that I can anyway, I'm trying to inform my congresspersons, the Senator, and the President.
I think you ought to run for Congress.
No. Anyway, I've been writing to our senators and congressmen and the President himself, and a lot of people are doing that. And I know one of the Minnesota senators, for example, has taken a much more open view of the Central American situation. In fact, I would say he has made a rather significant switch in favor of a more negotiated approach to that, rather than a military intimidation type of approach. So I think that we in this country have a marvelous, marvelous system whereby we can raise critical questions, and I think we have a responsibility to do it also, and a privilege to do it. So that's where I think we should spend a good deal of our effort, is attempting to inform, maybe prod our government officials to look at this more carefully. Other questions?
Do we still have that strong Somozan control group that you mentioned that was strong in Congress?
Oh, no, no. The Somozan dynasty was essentially eliminated. I think that there is a third generation Somozan alive yet today, a son. Anastasio was assassinated in South America, Paraguay, I think it was, in 1981. And that pretty much put an end to that. I'm not sure how we rounded up the former National Guardsmen and trained them here. I suspect that our CIA did it, I imagine. We have been groping around over the past few years attempting to find another faction or coalition within Nicaragua that could be put in place or encouraged as a government to run against the present government, but just haven't been able to find it. There isn't enough to put together there, and so we have made the effort then through this covert action to attempt to, well, now I should make this clear though. Ostensibly, we have armed and trained the contra-revolutionaries for the purpose of stopping the arms flow from Nicaragua to El Salvador. I'm sorry, I may be not being clear on that. But I hasten to add also that, the arms flow has essentially stopped. Our UN, the U.S. ambassador said, told the last group that went to Nicaragua this summer, that effectively that is not an issue anymore. So our reason for supporting the Contras has disappeared. That is the ostensible or the outward reason for supporting them. And as you've probably read in Newsweek and Time and others, the Contras have said our purpose is primarily to overthrow the government. So while we say we're supporting them for some other reason, we're very keenly aware that their intention runs a lot deeper than that.
Well, where does El Salvador fit into this picture?
El Salvador has a great deal of turmoil. There are revolutionary processes that are going on there that are not unlike the ones that took place in Nicaragua and that are also taking place in Guatemala. And our position there essentially is to support the military government in order to bring about peaceful conditions in that country using the military governments that are in place there. So we have taken essentially the same position that we did with the Somozan regime in those situations. I would have to say that I don't think that there is a Somozan dynasty or regime that is so focused in those countries. In fact, I'm sure that's the case. So it isn't as obvious what we should do in those countries. But I would say that to a great extent we ought to be considering the fact that revolution, those revolutions to a great extent are due to some of the internal poverty in those countries. We have sent down millions of dollars to quell the rebels in El Salvador. We have sent down $100,000 approximately per rebel. $100,000 per rebel, and we still can't put it down. Now that has to say something. At least it has to raise the question that there must be support, popular support for that, for some of the rebellion that's taking place in those countries. And the arguments of many is that is the basis of much of the revolution there. Not communist intervention, but the fact that people simply are living in conditions of poverty and oppression. But again, I don't know enough about those places other than the fact that there are some very glaring statistics that I think need some critical examination. There are hard questions involved here, that's for sure. There are complex issues involved. And one thing that is almost sad about this is that our foreign policy with regard to Nicaragua seems to be doing just what you'd expect that we wouldn't want to happen. It is probably creating another Cuba. Nicaragua is desperate for assistance. It has made pleas, it has pleaded with countries throughout the world, the United States among them, to say, please help us to rebuild this country. Send us teachers and healthcare people. And the Cuban government has sent some people there. There are Cubans there. The vast majority of them are working in healthcare and education. We asked Aldo Diaz in the foreign ministry, why are there so many Cubans here? And he came back with a very embarrassing question. He said, why aren't there more Americans here? So our foreign policy now, which is highly intimidating from a military standpoint, is such that Nicaragua is finding it increasingly more necessary to go to the Soviet Union to get arms. And I wouldn't be surprised if we have MiGs there pretty soon, or they have MiGs there. And that, in fact, it might turn into a Cuba. My goodness, we have an aircraft carrier with its eight supporting ships aimed at that country the size of Iowa. We have 5,000, maybe 6,000 troops doing military maneuvers within just a few miles of their northern border. What else can they do? They think we're going to invade them. Maybe not us, but that we're going to incite the Hondurans or someone, and certainly the Contras, to attack them. They have very little choice under the situation they're in now, but to take some measures to defend themselves.
Well, certainly they're not going to defend themselves with a few names against the U.S.
Well, they will, though, against the forces of the Honduran army military. Even our CIA issued a report not too many months ago, about 3 months ago. It said Nicaragua is receiving some arms from the Soviet Union, but they're almost totally defensive type weapons. Even our CIA report issued came out and said that. Which refutes an argument that one would tend to hear, and that is that they would be building up offensively in order to move, say, into Honduras or something else, which is an accusation they've leveled in us.
How much work is the Lutheran Church doing in Nicaragua?
To my knowledge, quite little. We have not had much presence there. In fact, the Protestant presence hasn't been terribly great there, although there is some. It is mostly Roman Catholic.
Would it be feasible to, send personnel from the church down there, teachers and various where they could be of help to the people?
There is presently a study being carried out now by the Lutheran churches. I think all of the synods, or at least three of them, have sent persons down there for the purpose of evaluating what presence the Lutheran Church could have there. Phil Anderson, in particular, has spent some time in Central America now evaluating just that question.
Have you had opportunity to speak in any of our church colleges on issues in Cuba?
No.
I think that would be very good to encourage our young people to.
I think there are a lot of people speaking on the Central American issue. The Center for Global Service has sponsored seminars probably for 150 to 200 people in the last year. And consistently we hear from those people, as well as other people that have gone to that place, very consistent stories of what is happening there. And I think a lot of them are speaking. There's a good deal of speaking on
this. This is a Catholic country.
Primarily, 90% of the Christians there are Roman Catholic.
With the popes asking the priests and all to get out of government positions, this has had no effect in Nicaragua.
The Ernesto Cardenal, who was the priest in the government that addressed the pope on that issue, and the pope said, "Get yourself straight with the church," has said that he wants to stay a priest, but also feels that he must stay in the government, although he considers his primary function to be that of a priest. There's a considerable amount of tension, or at least some tension, between the hierarchical church in Nicaragua and what is called the popular church in Nicaragua, which is made up of base Christian communities. There is some tension between those, and the conflict that we see in Nicaragua, where it has been stated, there is conflict in the church. That's primarily what it is, the church within the church in some kind.
These base Christian communities are basically Catholic.
Yes, because
that's
the people
all there
are.
Has been.
But there are Protestants who also are involved in the base Christian community.
Are those charismatic groups, or?
Yeah, I'm not sure. That.
Wasn't it just until, I'm not sure what the term recently would mean, but wasn't the church one of the main oppressors also along with the government?
Yeah. up until about the early 60s, until Vatican II, from the very, almost the very earliest history in those places, maybe with a little exception at the start, the church has been on the side of the well-to-do, the rich elite in Latin America. I think that general statement can quite clearly be made. It wasn't until Vatican II that started to change somewhat. There was a conference in 1968 in Medellin, Colombia. It was a bishops' conference where Latin American bishops gathered together and drew up some statements that said, in effect, that the church and the church's people should be more in the process of the struggle for human rights. That's summarizing it very quickly. And out of that came the base Christian communities and much of the support for liberation theology, which also developed as a result of that, but also even started to develop before that. So the Medellin conference was a very big event in Latin America and changed significantly the position of many of the clergy and lay people within the Catholic Church. So that is a relatively recent phenomenon that has taken place. And at the same time, there was a wave of new military dictatorships in Central America. So I think the very high level of turmoil in Latin and Central America has been to a great extent due to these things taking place.